So I've got some prepared remarks that I'm going to go through a little bit, not hurriedly, but a little quickly, because I do want to leave room, sizable room for questions, because this is a topic that I think will have a lot of opportunity for you to say, how does this push into the corners? That sounds great, but how do, I've got a situation, or I'm asking for a friend. So someone told me earlier in one of the breaks that they listened to me a lot on 2x speed, and I was going really slow in the 1x. So maybe I should go fast and be normal. So my talk title here is Masculinity Without Permission. Masculinity Without Permission. Now, relations between the sexes have rarely been in tatters the way they are now, because we've kicked against the authority of God, as revealed in the 5th chapter of Ephesians, as revealed in the created order, and as revealed in our own consciences. We have toppled from a great height. The world has been fallen, sinful, and rebellious throughout almost all of its history, but there are degrees of apostasy. There are degrees of apostasy, and there's no bad situation that cannot be somehow worsened with a bad attitude. The general sinful condition of man can be made worse when adorned with mandatory incoherence, which is where we are now. Relationships between the sexes are governed by the zeitgeist, the culture smog, and that demand is you must think about this like you're stupid. That's the mandate. Now, I've written in other places about the plague of fatherlessness and the resultant father hunger. This fatherlessness can come about because the father is actually physically gone, or he might still be on the premises, but distant and removed in other ways. You could even have fatherlessness result when the father's on the premises, wishing he could be involved, but doesn't know how to plug in. Because whenever he goes to plug in, I think this socket would work, and he gets blocked by something. He gets blocked by his wife, or gets blocked by one of the kids, or how do I give? How do I do this? Either way, the plague of fatherlessness has a threefold impact. Fatherlessness has a threefold impact on the miserable women who see their children abandoned by the one who fathered them, on the wretched women who chase away the one who fathered her children, and on the children themselves who struggle with a standing hunger and with no pattern or model to follow. And the world being the way it is, maybe some of you are in that position where you didn't have a model to follow and now you're a father yourself and you don't want to do the same thing to your kid, and how do I avoid that? As we confront this disaster, and it is a disaster, the definition of masculinity that I believe we must return to is this. This is how I define masculinity. Masculinity is the glad assumption of the sacrificial responsibilities that God assigned to men. The glad assumption of sacrificial responsibility. Now, this is the point where in normal times, if I were not writing to a culture that was not so well advanced in its pathological condition, I would hasten to add that masculinity is not bluster, bullying, self-seeking aggrandizement, abusive behavior, and so forth. I would qualify against the counterfeits. There are counterfeits, and we reject all those, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. All of it's quite true, but I don't want to emphasize it right now, because we live in a time when the genuine article is called toxic, right? In other words, there is such a thing as toxic masculinity, but we live in a time when any masculinity is considered toxic. So I don't want to qualify in such a way that you fail to pick up on what I'm driving at. Think of it this way. I've had pastoral situations where the husband and wife, it's an unhappy marriage, the husband is not leading, the wife is beyond exasperated at her husband not leading. Okay, it's one of those long-standing chronic headaches. And people are like, oh, if he would just begin to lead. If he would just take up his responsibility and exercise his authority in a godly, biblical way, I know that if he were to do that, things short-term in the family would get 10 times worse. Okay? The woman wants him to lead. No, not that way. I want you to lead where I thought we ought to be going. So, that's a problem. The reason for not yelling up that particular rain spout is that it has been counterproductive. We've been doing that in an unrelenting way for a generation or more. Don't be a bully, don't be a bully, don't be a bully. Okay? And sure, don't be a bully. That should go without saying here. But by doing this, we've helped to create and shape the awful conditions that we so lament. Let me explain. We need to be done with what we have come to call servant leadership. We need just to be done with servant leadership. Servant leadership, as it has been defined in evangelical circles, has done to masculinity what the liberals want to do to AR-15s. They want to ban them. What do I mean? I'm here following the common sense wisdom of the bumper sticker that says, when guns are outlawed, only outlaws will have guns. Servant leadership, defined the way it's popularly defined, is that men are to lead by serving. Okay, no, you're to serve by leading. You're not supposed to lead by serving, you're to serve by leading. Of course, Jesus washed his disciples' feet, of course. If you want to become great in the kingdom, you've got to become servant of all. All of that, that's biblical truth. If you want to become great in the kingdom, you've got to humble yourself and become servant of all. But you do, the way you humble yourself is you do what you're told to do. You obey, you submit. And what God told husbands and men to do is to be men, to lead their families, to take responsibility for their families, to make decisions, to be a wall of protection, to be tough. That's what we're called to do. We're not, and many evangelicals have been taught for a generation or more to behave in such a way as to make your wife almost a lesbian. That's no good. I'll give you a minute. When a false definition of servant leadership is mandated for the church, the only people who will ignore that teaching will be the dullards and the pigs. Okay, they will just flat out ignore it. The sincere Christian men who falsely believe that they're being taught in accordance with the word will dutifully disarm. They will disarm their masculinity for the sake of being a servant leader. Servant leadership is understood as finding out what your wife wants and then giving that to her. That's false. They will abdicate their essential role of actual leadership in the home, actual decision making, actual taking of responsibility. And they will call it servant leadership or leading from behind or just what I was going to suggest leadership. But there's a vast difference between real servant leadership, the kind Christ practiced and enjoined, and the kind that requires men to stand down whenever mama ain't happy. By so emphasizing servant leadership, the church has not succeeded in establishing more of it, but they have succeeded in giving men a noble-sounding name as a fig leaf for their cowardice. That's what we've done, is we've equipped men with a ready-made excuse. It's just been a disaster. Men need to be men, and being a man means that there will be times when you exasperate your wife. Now, there's a good way to exasperate her, and there's a bad way to exasperate her, and I wrote a book, How to Exasperate Your Wife. One of the men in our congregation looked at that and said, oh, good, lessons. Yeah, you know about the bad kind. Don't do the bad kind, but there are times when you go, men have many characteristics, and one of them is that they hate conflict with their wives. They hate conflict with their wives. And they consequently get more of it by rolling over right away. Okay, and it's just you pay the Dane Geld, and sure enough, next season, the Danes are back. When the decent men are laboring to be not so masculine, and the pigs lean into being quote-unquote masculine, the end result will be that we will start having to deal with this thing called toxic masculinity. Now, he'd be a fool who said there was no such thing as a toxic, overdone masculinity. There certainly is, and I've had to deal with it pastorally in different situations. I've seen some remarkable specimens of it. But feminism has created it. Accommodations with feminism nurture it. And so now we've gotten to the point where ordinary standard issue masculinity is declared to be toxic by definition. This has only happened because the feminist mind starts by banning AR-15s and ends by banning anything that might, in any possible world, remind them of one. And so a husband who says, well, this is what we're going to do. You know, we need a plan. We have to decide right now, this is what we're going to do. And he gets immediate resistance from his wife. That clash is considered a bad thing, or that tension is considered a bad thing. No, it's just the way the world is. So the liberal mind starts by saying that it is common sense to keep guns out of schools, but they always end by expelling the kid who ate his Pop-Tart into the shape of a gun. That's where it ends, right? They say, well, common sense, get rid of guns. But now the liberal mind, the progressive mind, is never, ever content with that kind of thing. And the banning mentality goes down to, you know, expel the kid because he used a finger gun. There are two kinds of miserable women. God has created woman for the man, and she wants to be in relationship with him. But the bond of this relationship, called covenant, has been rejected. Covenants have stipulations, terms, standards, and patterns. Most importantly, a covenant has a head. Okay? You can't have a covenant without a covenant head. And that head is the husband. Covenants are inescapably bound together by that thing called authority. And in our generation, by abandoning the concept of authority, we have destroyed the fundamental protection for women and children that God has established in the world. Men are supposed to be hard. They're supposed to be hard for their families, not hard on their families. Okay, you want to be a wall of protection, you want to be a provider and protector, and you need to be hard in order to do that, and you need to be hard for their benefit, rather than being hard on them. Sometimes being hard for them is going to be felt by, you know, if a disagreement about something with your wife and she feels it as a hardship, that should be something she feels as hard, but it's not really hard. You're not being hard on her, even though she might feel that in the moment. That you can tell that that's the situation when she comes back and thanks you later. Thank you. So, I'll give you an example of that. When my family was very tight, lived in Moscow. Nancy's family was a very tight family, lived in Coeur d'Alene, which is just an hour and a half away. And her family was the kind of family that somebody in the family would rent a lake cabin for a week on Lake Coeur d'Alene and then invite everybody. All right, come one, come all, family reunion. And I would say things like, we're going to go for 2 days. The whole week is available. I said, we're going to go for 2 days. And the reason we're going to go for 2 days is because I'm not going to have my vacation assigned to me by extended family. We're going to make our own decisions about vacation. But we can go for 2 days. We can be gracious and accommodating and stuff. And Nancy would always feel the tug. Oh, it's my folks, it's the family, we're going to all be together. Couldn't we go for longer? I said, 2 days. And then when we're driving home, she would say, thank you. thank you. and this is a, there are a bunch of things involved in this, but my father-in-law was, he's now with the Lord. He was a bomber pilot for 23 years in the Air Force, went through World War II, went through the Korean War. He was a hard case, you know, just great dad, but he was a hard man. And when Nancy and I were first married, he and I had some epic collisions, you know, just epic collisions. And I had a brother-in-law who married Nancy's sister who got rolled by his father-in-law. And after the epic collisions, I had a great, great relationship with him. And he sweetened and softened, just became a very gentle man at the end of his life, and had a wonderful relationship. And my brother-in-law, who lost to him, didn't have that great relationship. One of the things that a man is supposed to do is to win respect. Okay, win respect. You want the respect of your family, and you want the respect of those who are outside that members of your family already respect. So, for example, my wife already respected her dad highly, and the fact that I was able to stand up to him and win his respect was a great blessing to Nancy in her attitude toward me. And that meant drawing lines that were initially, oh, can we go longer? And no, 2 days. So that's just one illustration. So men and women, because of our problems, men and women are no longer together in covenant, and so miserable women have to make shift. They still have a deep creational need to be in relationship with men, but they must come up with their own bonds to maintain that relationship. And they do that in one of two ways. First, they'll accept the doctrine that they must tart themselves up. Okay, that's one way to keep the bond. That's the one way to keep men around. They become disciples of Cosmopolitan magazine, where they set themselves to the catechetical task of learning 5,892 ways of driving their man crazy in bed. These are the women who have been brought to think that sex is the glue that holds a man to a woman, and they think that porn stars and random celebrities can show them the way. But sex is not the glue. Sex is the thing that must be glued. Sex is not the glue. Sex is the thing that must be glued. And the only thing strong enough to bind the strong man, the strong man of sex, is a covenant made in the fear of God. That will bind it. But we've thrown such covenants away. We don't even know what they are anymore. A covenant is a solemn bond, sovereignly administered with attendant blessings and curses. And covenants, if I may speak this way, covenants don't care. That's their strength. Think of your, go down to your basement and pat the basement wall. Right? It's straight lines, cold, gray concrete, and it doesn't care. It holds the house up. The house is held up straight that way. You go up into the living room and you look at all the sentimental things that your wife has done in the living room, the curtains, carpet, cushions, sofa. Make a big pile out of those soft things and try to put a stud wall on top of it. It's just going to be as wobbly as all get out. In order to have a stable marriage, you have to have a covenant commitment at the foundation that will not budge. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how you feel. It doesn't matter how I feel. It's like Ben Shapiro says, math doesn't care about your feelings. Well, neither do covenants. You went into a church, and you stood up front of the church with this pretty girl, and you promised that you would say and do certain things, and you wouldn't say and do other things, and you promised with God as a witness and a bunch of people gathered around. That covenant is something, you gave your word, so keep your word. But she, doesn't matter. does not matter. Okay, so covenant. The second kind of woman seeks to stay in relationship with men by means of a power move. Women who choose not to be sexually provocative, and that could either be by choice or by necessity, they might not be in a position to be sexually provocative, or they might just be reticent to do that, can still wield influence through fear. And our culture has granted this power to women also, promising to back such women up when they decide to make their accusations, whatever their accusations might be. So we're living in a time where if a woman accuses a man of striking her or raping her or molesting her, she goes into the court hearing. He goes into the court hearing with two strikes against him, if not three strikes against him. Because the mantra coming out of the Me Too movement was, believe all women, believe all women, believe all men. Now, of course, that can't be, that was never religiously followed. It was only a political tool, because nobody believed the women that Joe Biden messed with. People didn't believe women there. But that is still entered into the into sort of our default assumptions. So our culture has decided to back the woman up. This is what the blank check of always believe the victim actually means. It is not to choose women over men. It is to choose women over the rule of law. And so it is that a large army of singularly unattractive and bitchy women have come to have any authority in our culture at all. And you look around and say, how is it that they are in charge? How's that possible? Men go along because of fear. Men go along because of fear. Women are being given a genuinely unpalatable choice, hookers or harpies. Because there's the covenant, who knows about covenant anymore? That's what kept a man faithful to his woman. He made a promise. And that's what kept a woman faithful to her man. She made a promise. And that promise was not just a promise, yeah, I'll meet you at 10 at the coffee shop. It was a covenant commitment solemnly administered with attendant blessings and curses. The option of being a woman prized above rubies by a man who fears Jehovah, that's off the table. Toxic, it's triggering. A man who loves one woman more than life itself is clearly a threat to everyone. And actually, he is. All right, let me say that again. A man who loves one woman more than life itself is clearly a threat. He's a threat to the devil and his lies. So what do I mean by masculinity without permission? I mean that men who want to be obedient to God in this faithless generation are going to need to walk up four steep hills. There are three basic governments that I touched on in the conference, three basic governments that God has established among men: the civil government, the government of the church, and the government of the family. In our time, all three of them are in disarray. All three. And all three are deeply compromised. We live in a time when any attempts to restore godly order to any or all of the three will be fiercely attacked. If you want to live as a godly husband to a godly wife and a godly father to children who being brought up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, you are clearly power tripping. And if you are a pastor or an elder that believes that Hebrews 13:17, that the congregation of the Lord needs to be ruled, obey those who have the rule over you, the scripture says, obey those who have the rule over you. Well, pastors and elders have authority over the congregation within the bounds that God has assigned, just like family has a certain boundaries. The church is the ministry of grace and peace, or the ministry of word and sacrament. The family is the ministry of health, education, and welfare. And the civil government is the ministry of justice. That's rough and ready. The civil government's job is to make it safe for you to walk across town at 2 a.m. That's their job. The family's job is to provide for medical care, food, shelter, health, education, welfare, that sort of thing. And the church's responsibility is to preach the word of God and administer the sacraments. Preach the gospel, administer the sacraments. So, any attempt to restore godly order to any of these three will be first fiercely attacked. I mentioned there were four hills. The first step out of our confusion is this. The fourth and steepest hill is the one of individual commitment. This occurs in the realm of self-government. Christian men must come to understand that there's been a vast conspiracy to neuter them, that make them spiritual eunuchs. They must decide before God that they are done cooperating with this demented program, and they're going to walk away from it without permission. They're not going to get permission to walk away from it. They're going to say before God, I'm going to be the man that God's called me to be, and I'm not going to go with my hat in my hand to anybody else to ask if this is what I ought to do. I'm just going to start doing it. Walk away from without permission. They need to decide that they are going to be masculine without a license from the civil magistrate. They're going to be masculine even if it means foregoing that servant leadership stamp of approval from the elders, which in many cases it almost certainly will. The elders will say, oh, you know. And they're going to be masculine, and this is where really troublesome, they're going to be masculine without a permission slip from their wife. They're going to be masculine without a permission slip from their wife. Women are in a tough spot because they are two creatures at the same time. They are a woman created by God to fit into a certain relationship with the man. What they are creationally. And what they are creationally is they want a strong, godly man to lead them, protect them, provide for them. They really do want that, and they want that all the way down to their toes. They want it. At the same time, women, believe it or not, women can sin. Now, we live in a time when this is neglected in churches, right? I heard a woman say when she came to our church, she was new to the church, and in one part of the sermon, I said, "Now, you wives, you need to be careful about this." And so first, everybody knows that men and women can both sin if the sin is gender neutral, right? If the sin is something like embezzling from your employer, then a man can commit that and a woman can commit that. The thing that gets everybody's ire up is where you address distinctively feminine sins, okay? If you're a woman, watch out for this. If you're a woman, resist this particular temptation because you're going to be tempted in this area. That sets the cat among the pigeons, right? Why did you attack all women? From the pulpit, no less. Well, I didn't attack all women. I told them not to gad about from house to house. That was the Apostle Paul, actually. And then they say, that's another thing. I don't like that Paul guy, you know? Because he says things like this. Well, if I say, and what people have said, if a pastor can't address distinctively feminine sins from the pulpit, or if a husband can't address a specifically feminine temptation as he's talking with his wife, encouraging her, leading her, let's say we give that up. What we're saying is that the women in our lives are going to be left unpastored, unshepherded, uncared for, and neglected. That's what we're saying. Well, that's what they demanded. Well, we should say, tough. What did God tell you to do? Not what did she tell you to do, but what did God tell you to do? So, you're going to need to be masculine without permission slip from your wife. And when men do this, it should not bother them that the elders wring their hands while pointing out that Jordan Peterson is not a Christian. And neither is Andrew Tate. He's not a Christian either. A bunch of these guys online are not Christians. And so why are young men in the church finding them more valuable than the stuff that they hear from the pulpit? In many churches, what we have come to believe is that the ideal Christian male is the beta male. That's the ideal Christian. And there are a number of things that go into this. But why, so Jordan Peterson's not a Christian. That's right, he's not. So why is he sounding more biblical than you guys? Why is the non-Christian sounding more biblical than the guy who's been to seminary? The fact that he's not a Christian should not be the foundation of your argument. It should be the foundation of your embarrassment. After all, when Jesus referred to those who were made eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom, this enterprise is not what he was talking about. Matthew 19:12. So, give one example, maybe two, and then open it up for questions. Let's say you've got a situation where the wife has been, totally hypothetical, read about it in a book, okay? The wife has been saying, honey, other families do family worship, they have family devotions. The husband reads the Bible to the kids. Other families do that. I was talking to Susie and Sally and Henrietta, and they do that, and why can't we do that? And his motive is thinking, you know, if I say I'm going to do something, no need to remind me every 6 months. I'm going to do it, right? And so she brings it up and brings it up and brings it up, and then she buys a Christian book or two at the Christian bookstore, dog-ears them, leaves them around in suggestive places on his nightstand or the coffee table, and he finally gets the message, and he thinks, okay, yeah, we should do family devotions. So that evening, between dinner and dessert, before dessert is served, he goes and gets the Bible and sits down to read a passage. And when he sits down to read the passage, he opens the Bible, and she gets up and goes to do the dishes. And what's a typical man going to think at this point? He's going to say, you've been bugging me for months to read the Bible to the family, and the first thing that you do, the very first thing that you do when I go to do it, is you give me static. You make it hard for me. You go do the dishes. And if you have some pots and pans in the sink, you're going to clatter them. What's going on? Well, she knows that the only reason he's doing this is because she bugged him. But she doesn't want him reading the Bible to the family because she bugged him. She wants him reading the Bible to the family because he wants to, because he's obeying God, because he means it. Okay? So she knows that the ice on this lake, that she's being asked to walk out on a frozen lake, she knows the ice might not be that thick. So she throws a cinder block out. That's what she's doing. And what he needs to do is, without losing his temper, without being annoyed, without getting flustered at all, he needs to say something like, woman, we're going to read the Bible now. Now, this laps over to another thing. Many men are the kind of person who they are incapable of standing up to their wives without getting into sin. The only way they've ever stood up to a woman is by getting into sin. I can stand up to her if I've lost my temper. And then whatever good things I might have said during that exchange, I have to apologize for everything afterwards because I lost my temper. I was clearly the one in the wrong. And so many times, husbands, the only time they assert themselves at all is when they're clearly not walking with God. They're clearly not it. They're not. And so one of the, here's the challenging assignment for you. And I'm not saying every last one of you is in this position. I'm just saying that most of you are. Here's your assignment. Look for an opportunity over the next few weeks to decide to do something that your wife would rather not do. You have a discussion, and it could be as trivial as Chinese or Mexican, you know, it could be trivial, or it could be a more momentous thing. I advise you to start with the trivial one. You need practice in the shallow end, right? Honey, we're moving to the Yukon. I'm going to pan for gold. It's going to be great. don't start there. But pick something that you know that you, maybe it's a standing issue that you've had disagreements about, and you want to make a decision. And your assignment is to bring that discussion to a head in a particular instance, and you win. It's not competitive. What you're doing is you're winning for the whole family. It's not you winning. But you maintain your position. That's number one. You maintain it. And number two, without getting into sin. Without getting annoyed, without getting irritated, without getting exasperated, without bullying her. Just say, this is what we're going to do. I've been thinking and praying about it. And talk to her three or four times before you make the decision. Honey, we've talked about this a number of times. But let's spend over the next couple of weeks, let's talk about it some more. And you can repeat back to her the arguments that she offers against it. And you say, I'm going to think and pray about it. And you really do. You think and pray about it. And then you decide. And you decide to do the thing that you think is better than what she suggested. And then you stick to your guns. Okay. Now, you say, this is not... The chaos of my family is not, this is not worth it. Are you asking me to disrupt my family? Well, my question is, why would it be disruptive? It would be disruptive because the hierarchy of your household is not in order. That's why this would be disruptive, okay? And if you do it graciously, if you do it firmly, if you do it with all the fruit of the Spirit in evidence, and you carry on all the way through, your wife is really going to appreciate it. It's going to be a blessing for her. You're not doing it for you. You're doing it for her. You want to minister to your family. So you're not leading by serving. You're serving by leading. And you have to learn how to do that. Right? You have to learn how to do that. Okay, there are lots of things I could say, but let me not do that. Are there any questions? Yeah. It doesn't look, when you move from more trivial decisions to the larger decisions, it looks a little bit different in that you have more conversations about it, you hear her concerns more carefully and make sure, you know, it's a weightier issue. But all the principles are the same. And one of the things that happens is if you're doing it right on these smaller issues, the more trivial issues, what that is doing is building trust. And there are times, and this reminds me of another thing, there are times when you've had this back and forth, and let's say she really wants to do a picnic at the lake this coming Saturday. You'd rather not go out, you'd rather not burn another Saturday. But she really wants to. And you have this conversation, a trivial issue, and you might, as the leader of the home, say, okay, let's do the picnic. Let's do what you're suggesting. And then one of your arguments against doing it was that it's going to rain. And let's say you get up there by the lake and there's a torrential downpour. You are totally vindicated. And you all run to the car and you're all soaking wet in the car. And she's a godly Christian woman, so she says, I am so sorry that I talked you into, you know, I'm so sorry. This was my idea. This was my bad. And you should say something like, oh, no, I was the one that decided that we were going to do this. This is me. Instead of, I told you, instead of you, look what happens when we follow your dumb ideas. that's not what I'm talking about. So basically, when the decision is made, if you make the decision the way that you were urging, you take responsibility. If you make the decision the way she was urging, you take responsibility. Right? You take responsibility both ways. And if you practice that on nickel dime things, on school pickup things, on what movie you're going to watch, what restaurant you're going to go to, if you practice this discipline of making a decision and sticking with it without getting out of fellowship, you're building trust. And then in the big decisions, you are more careful, spend more time on it, but the principle is the same. And it's not an alien sensation when you make a decision and she defers, when she submits to it. Yeah. Okay, how old are your children?
I have a 3-year-old, a 1-year-old, and a first trimester.
And are you in a Pado Baptist church, or are you?
We just went here. We're coming from SBC and PCA, kind of balancing that between.
And when she sees infant baptisms done here, what is her reaction? Okay, on the assumption that she's not faking sickness, checking the bulletin beforehand, and okay, so if that's truly a providential thing, basically you're hauling a 10-pound fish in on a 5-pound line. It's a momentous decision. I wouldn't just exercise the raw, okay, we're going to do this now, yet. Okay, what I would encourage you to do is wait long enough for her to see it done, right? To see the parents take the vows and have her get used to the idea. Culture is a huge thing, right? I'll never forget when my grandchildren the first time they saw an adult being baptized in church, they thought it was the weirdest thing in the world. He's all grown. What's he doing up there? Because all the baptisms they'd seen were babies. And I had a good friend who'd grown up in a Pado Baptist church who came to a profession of faith baptism, and he was like 40, 45 years old, and he'd never seen a profession of faith baptism, and it was just culturally unusual, right? So you've got all the things, you've got two things. You've got the doctrinal issues, you've got all the cultural things that you're imagining about it, and then you've got the emotional heartstrings issue, right? So basically on this issue, I think there may come a time where you'll have to just say, this is what we're going to do. But I would give her more time, and I'd give her more time to acclimatize and see the parents making vows. For example, I know that I could speak to a group of Southern Baptist women, and I could tell baptism stories that would make a third of the women go, "Oh, it's." Women usually catch on quicker than men do. Right? And what has to be overcome is sort of the cultural barrier thing. I would let that break the ice, let her see 2 or 3 instances of it, have follow-up conversations, answering the questions, and then let her know, okay, we're going to have to decide sometime, and let's give ourselves time to work through this and give her fair warning beforehand, and then at some point say, honey, I'm going to have to ask you to follow me, but I wouldn't just go right to it. Let me illustrate it. This is you know what it's like when your kids are playing, it's in the summertime, and they're in the backyard playing hard. There's no school, and they're playing, the sun goes down late, and it's 8:30, 8:45, and they're playing hard. And if you go out on the back porch and say, bedtime, everybody's going 60 miles an hour, and you just had them drive into a brick wall. So what you should do is go out on the back porch and say, 10 minutes. Everybody gets adjusted. They know what's happening. They know where we're going. If you've joined this church, she knows. As Bob Dylan said, you don't need to be a weatherman to tell which way the wind is blowing. Right? She knows that she's in a Paedobaptist church. She needs to just be brought along gently. But at some point, you've got to make sure it happens. Another question.
Doug, we've been talking about this in the context of husbands and wives. Any thoughts to share on dads and their children, particularly their sons? It looks very different, but I see a lot of young men who seem to want to be friends first, and then a father later. And so they seem to be negotiating or discussing like they are with their spouse, but it's their child. So how's the danger of that?
Yeah, he is. So the temptation of fathers and mothers who want to be friends with their kids first and father or mother second, it's a perennial temptation and it's really bad. It's the same thing is true of teachers. Teachers in a Christian school who want to be friends with the class, you're a teacher. You shouldn't want to be friends. You should be a teacher who's friendly. You should be a father who's friendly and accepting, but your central role is that of a father. They've got other friends. They only have one father. And so fathers should be a father from day one. And if a father is being a true father to his kids, that's the foundation for real friendship later when they're grown. Our three kids are our best friends. But one of the reasons they're our best friends is they weren't our friends at all when they were little. You're not old enough or smart enough to be a friend. Of course, we didn't put it like that. we were kinder. Yeah. Yes.
Any advice in that, both to moms raising adolescent teenage boys and boys growing up with moms?
Okay, so I would, the advice to the mom first would be minimize commands. Don't remove them entirely because you're still their mom. It says in Proverbs, obey the law of your mother. Okay, you're his mother and he's a foot and a half taller than you. So you still have authority, but use that authority judiciously. And then you as dad, make sure that whenever she does exercise authority and say, go do this or go do that, that his obedience of her is with you standing right behind her. You back her up. So and this is something that you can... I forget how old my son was. He was very little, probably preschool. And he was having different clashes with his mom. And I had a talk with him one evening. I said, Nate, are you having trouble obeying your mom because she's a girl? He said, yeah. Yeah. And I said, well, that's too bad. You have to obey your mom, but I want you to understand that your mom and I, as far as this is concerned, are a unit. We're a unit. So to obey her is to obey me, and I want you to have a looming shadow of me right behind her when she tells you to do something. But at the same time, there has to be an understanding in the family that as the kids are growing to the point where they leave the nest, all the house rules that you have are going to be clean gone. Right? If your son joins the Navy and he's in Manila Bay, none of your house rules are pertinent at all. Right? So if he's not internalized the things you're talking about by that point, then is what good is it? But that means you have to practice seeing whether they've internalized them the last couple of years before they leave. And so that's one of the reasons why you encourage your wife to not give as many direct commands, maybe cut them by 3/4. Don't give direct commands. And I would say dad should do the same thing, where you're lifting restrictions, lifting rules off. And many Christian parents flip this around. When kids are little and sin, it doesn't, sometimes even cute, sin is funny or cute or doesn't do much damage, they indulge. And then when the kids head into the teenage years, they clamp down, the parents get frightened. Oh no, now you can get pregnant, or now you can get somebody pregnant, or now you can wreck a car and wreck your life. And so they start clamping rules down. But the kid's been undisciplined for 10 years, 15 years, and now all of a sudden rules. That's just going to provoke rebellion. So what you need to do is be, we were a totalitarian police state when the kids were little, established our authority, and then as they grew older, we lifted rules. We removed them so that when my daughter was 16, for example, we said, Becca, you can watch any movie you want. If your friends want to go to a movie, you don't have to check with us. We were super strict on entertainment standards when they're little, but then we lifted the restriction later.